Hello and welcome to Radio Prague's weekend program with me, Jan Richter. Coming up in today's show, in Czech books, we look at the life of the Canadian historian Gordon Skilling, who witnessed some of the most important moments of modern Czech and Slovak history. Then in Czech science, we'll have a look at how Czechs will participate in a new European probe to the sun. And later, we bring back our popular miniseries from the archives, so please stay tuned for all of that. But first, this year is the 100th anniversary of the birth of the Canadian historian Gordon Skilling. As we have already reported on Radio Prague, the anniversary has been marked by an international conference and an exhibition at Prague's Kampa Museum, a rare honor for an academic. But Gordon Skilling was different. Between 1937 and his death in 2001, he was in Prague or Bratislava for many of the most important moments in 20th century Czechoslovak history, and this gave him a very close and personal relationship to the Czechs and Slovaks. David Vaughan continues.
Gordon Skilling was in Prague in September 1938, when the Munich Agreement cut the country to pieces, and he remained here long enough to witness the beginning of the German occupation in March 1939. After the war, he was to return many times, and following the Soviet invasion of 1968, he was untiring in his support of Czech and Slovak dissidents. At the same time, he was a meticulous historian, and the research material he collected included many samizdat publications, now preserved in the University of Toronto Library. Few would question his status as the most important North American historian of Czechoslovak 20th century history, with books covering subjects as diverse as the pre-World War I ideas of Tomáš Masaryk and the history of Charter 77. During the 70s and 80s, Skilling's support of dissidents extended to smuggling journals and books into Czechoslovakia, and among his dissident friends was Václav Havel, whom he visited at his cottage in Hradeček. I was lucky enough to meet and interview Gordon Skilling in 2000. Paying a visit to Prague was something of a homecoming for him, because he had worked in our station's predecessor, the shortwave service of Radiožurnál, in 1938, just at the time of the Munich crisis. Here is a short extract from a news bulletin at the height of the crisis in September 1938 that is almost certainly Gordon Skilling's voice. He is responding to German radio propaganda about alleged Czech atrocities.
Once again tonight we must perform the distasteful task of refuting further invented reports broadcast by the German wireless stations. It is not true that the rectors and deans of the German universities in Prague were forced, at the point of the gun, to sign a declaration of loyalty to the state. This absurd allegation was denied by the rectors and deans themselves in a statement made today, denying that any pressure whatever was used against them.
Here is the whole of the interview I recorded with Gordon Skilling back in 2000.
I decided to do a research on Czech history for my doctorate at the University of London. And I came here to do my research, and then I was fortunate to be employed by Radiožurnál, broadcasting in English to North America. And this happened to coincide with the crisis at the time leading up to Munich. I prepared an English bulletin based on Czech news bulletins and the newspapers, and broadcast pretty regularly.
The Italian Prime Minister, Mussolini, today made a speech in Trieste in which he touched on the most important problem of the present time, the Czechoslovak problem. The Italian minister believed that a plebiscite was the only possible solution, a plebiscite for all nationalities in Czechoslovakia which demand it and who are forced, he said, to stay in a state which wishes to be a great Czechoslovakia.
When the crisis heightened before and during Munich, I did some other broadcasts for CBS and NBC. At that time, as you may know, there descended on Prague hordes of international journalists. It was, I think, almost the first occasion of this kind of international broadcasting, and very many famous journalists came.
This is Reynolds Packard, United Press correspondent in Prague.
This is John T. Whitaker of the Chicago Daily News at the microphone. This is Eleanor Packard, United Press correspondent in Czechoslovakia.
This is William L. Shire speaking from Prague and returning you now to America.
Occasionally I was asked to do a broadcast on the crisis as it developed for the American networks.
And what do you remember of the atmosphere during the Munich crisis? I mean, for example, did people really believe that Britain and France would abandon Czechoslovakia?
I think by that time they were aware that Chamberlain was going to sell them down the river. I mean, during the summer of 1938, they still hoped, of course, that they would be given the green light to resist. But they knew that Chamberlain and Daladier were more or less willing to grant Germany its demands. And so the crisis, the final culmination of the crisis, came as no surprise. But I witnessed the mobilization of September 1938. And that was a very splendid display of readiness to resist, and courage, and relief, really, that the crisis, they thought, was over, and they would have a chance to fight, if necessary. So it was a great letdown. The troops went off to the borders, and the planes were ready. But unfortunately, President Benesch decided to capitulate and to give way to the British and French demands. We at the time thought that resistance was possible and desirable, and in fact some of the Czechoslovak generals felt the same way, and some of the political leaders. But I do remember a great mass meeting in what is now Jan Palach Náměstí, a huge meeting of protest against Germany and Munich, at which leaders of the main pro-resistance parties, from the communists to the extreme nationalists, spoke. And that was an electric occasion, because tens of thousands of Czech workers streamed in through the streets to this square. So there was a readiness to resist, but it was undermined by Benesch's willingness to give way to British and French pressures.
And personally, as a journalist having come from abroad, it must have been a key moment for you, because suddenly, presumably, it was very difficult for you to distance yourself from the events.
Well, we didn't distance ourselves. We felt complete and total sympathy with the Czechs, Czechoslovakia, and we hoped that there would be resistance. And we also hoped, perhaps, that the readiness to resist would deter Nazi Germany from attack. That was probably a vain hope. But we shared the hopes and aspirations and the fears of the Czechs and the Slovaks, and were very much let down when Munich ended all hopes of any kind of resistance. I remember the man in charge of my section in Radio Journal, I think his name was Kraus. He was so angry and upset by Munich that he threw his French Légion d'honneur into the Vltava. And there were other individual acts of protest of that kind that I recall.
How long was it before you decided to leave?
Well, we decided to stay because I was continuing and trying to finish my doctoral thesis on the relations of Czechs and Germans in Bohemia in the 19th century. It was a little ironic that I was working on that subject, and I was desperately trying to finish. And we decided to stay on after the German... Oh, we were there during the German occupation. That was 6 months later, after Munich. And we stayed on for a month or two. I think we left in probably April of 1939. I went to Vienna to do a little more concluding work on my thesis. Of course, Vienna, Austria, was under Nazi German rule. And finally left and went to France for a holiday, and then took the last Channel steamer to England the night before Chamberlain declared war on Germany. So it was quite an exciting and important series of events in our lives, and we came to identify ourselves very closely with the Czechs and the Slovaks and retain our close identity over the many, many years since that time.
In what ways in your subsequent life and career have you returned again to the subject or to your interest in Czechs and Slovaks?
Well, again and again, because I kept on my interest in Czechoslovakia, the history, and that later on its politics under communism, and I wrote a great deal about those matters and frequently visited Czechoslovakia. I wrote a book called Czechoslovakia's Interrupted Revolution, which was a detailed study of the Prague Spring and its crushing by the Soviet tanks. And then later on, I wrote another book on Charter 77, with whom we were also very closely associated, and made many visits during the 60s, 70s, and 80s to Prague and to Bratislava. So it was a lifetime link.
In 1992, Gordon Skilling was awarded Czechoslovakia's highest honour, the Honour of the White Lion, which he received from President Václav Havel. You can find out more about his long and fascinating life in his autobiography, The Education of a Canadian, My Life as a Scholar and Activist, published by Carleton University Press in 2000.
That was David Warne with a new edition of Czech Books. You're listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. Coming up next in Czech science, we are not going so very far from Earth today, only 2.5 light minutes or so, to a point where, come 2017, Czech technology will be orbiting our sun and helping to answer some of its secrets. Christian Falvey reports.
What we're talking about is the largest ever international study of our star, the Solar Orbiter, a European probe that will come closer to the sun than any of its predecessors, and hopefully it will yield information impossible to attain from the Earth or from Earth orbit. The last solar orbiter, the Euro-American SOHO, has already outlived its lifespan by 3 times, so this project means the next-generation solar probe. What will it bring to science and to popular understanding, and what Czech science can bring to it, is a question best put to Dr. František Farník, the head of the Solar Department of the Astronomical Institute of the Czech Academy of Sciences.
Solar Orbiter is a new solar mission in the European Space Agency, ESA. And ESA organizes science program in a period of 10 years. The next 10-year period starts 2015 and ends 2025. And during that period, which is called Cosmic Vision, 3 medium-sized missions and 1 large science mission should be completed and launched. One of those missions is Solar Orbiter, which is already under preparation, under studies for many years now. And in fact, the original launch date was shifted due to many reasons. And this year, it was confirmed by ESA, the Science Committee of ESA, that Solar Orbiter will be launched as the first medium-class mission in 2017. And the aim of the mission is the studies of the sun. The mission will fly to the vicinity of the sun. It will be as close as Mercury, and it means roughly 28% of the distance between the sun and the Earth. And it will be a complex observatory.
And what exactly will it be studying? Can you give me some examples of the range of studies that will be going on board?
It will observe the sun remotely. It means it will contain a few telescopes in ultralight, in visible, and also in X-rays. And also it will study in situ. It means it will register waves and particles in the position of the satellite of this observatory. And all those observations in different regions of the spectrum and also in the broad region of the energies of energetic particles is aimed at understanding our sun, of physical processes which are governing the solar activity, and also one of the main goals is to enable us to forecast solar activity, because it is known that solar activity may influence the Earth. In some senses, it may be very dangerous, and therefore it would be very helpful to be able to forecast this activity and to get ready for the negative influence.
And what will the Czech Republic be offering the project?
Czech Republic is involved in the mission in a few scientific instruments. We are having five groups of scientists involved in those instruments. One of those instruments is STIX. It is X-ray telescope, and that's my field. So in the case of X-ray telescope STIX, we develop and deliver two power supplies for that instrument. General power supply, which will feed the instrument as a whole, and also high voltage power supply, which will feed the metrics of detectors. Plus, we should develop and deliver the software which will control the instrument in flight. We should develop and deliver some components of the optical system, so optical elements.
And success in a huge project like this is kind of a two-way street, isn't it? Your contribution adds to the success of the project, but the experience of working on it itself enhances your own abilities and what you can do in the future, doesn't it?
Yes, that's precise. And this is also our idea to help Czech industry to be more visible, to get some experience in such a big project. Because, of course, European competition is very strong, and without any previous successes, it must be extremely difficult for industrial firms to win competition in other missions and other projects. And if Czech firms will be successful in Solar Orbiter, it will open more possibilities for those firms in the future. So this is, I would say, side product of our scientific goals.
Dr. František Farník there, the head of the Solar Department of the Astronomical Institute of the Czech Academy of Sciences. And it's wonderful to think about Czech technology in the darkness of space flying around the sun. That's all we have time for today on Science Journal. I hope you'll be back with us again next month.
That edition of Czech Science by Christian Falvey was first broadcast in December 2011. Coming up next, a rerun of our popular series From the Archives by David Vaughan.
For a few weeks in the late summer of 1989, Prague became the scene of a bizarre and now largely forgotten refugee crisis. It had all begun in the spring, when Hungary had declared its decision to take down the barbed wire on its borders with Austria. A growing number of East Germans, desperate at the suffocating lack of reform in their country, took advantage of this new gap in the Iron Curtain as a way of fleeing to the West. But smuggling themselves into Austria was an uncertain business, and before long they started seeking refuge at the West German Embassy in Budapest, and then in Prague, which was much closer to home than Hungary and easier to get to, as East German citizens did not need a visa. On August the 23rd, 1989, the West German Embassy, in the exquisite Baroque Lobkowitz Palace just below Prague Castle, was forced to close down for its day-to-day business. By then, hundreds of East Germans were trying to get in,
many climbing over the fence into the manicured embassy gardens. The surrounding streets were soon packed with their abandoned Trabants and Wartburgs. In an interview for Radio Prague, the Czech writer Jáchym Topol later recalled the scenes.
Měli na vozech ty peřiny a táhli batohy s jídlem a ubrčený malí děti a ty děti ztrácely.
They had piles of blankets. They were carrying backpacks with food. Children were crying, dropping their toys. It's strange, but it reminded me of the persecution of the Jews. In my mind's eye, I could see the convoys of refugees from the time of the war. To this day, I'm convinced that this East German exodus was the beginning of our own revolution. In the following days, the Red Cross was brought in, and tents were set up as the number of people in the embassy garden grew. This young man is describing how the conditions are becoming catastrophic. A woman, he says, has just given birth right here in the garden. Prague's official media needed to find a scapegoat for the crisis. This is what a Czechoslovak press agency report had to say.
The mass media and certain political circles in West Germany have been organising a campaign to encourage the illegal emigration of citizens of the German Democratic Republic.
With a humanitarian crisis looming, something had to be done. Behind the scenes, frantic talks were going on between West and East German leaders and with the Czechoslovak authorities. On September the 30th, the West German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher arrived in Prague, and at 7 in the evening he appeared on the balcony of the West German Embassy, looking down over the crowds in the garden. I have come here, he said, in order to inform you that today your departure... And at this point, his words were drowned by a huge cheer. Everyone knew that Genscher had managed to agree terms for the East Germans to be allowed to leave for the West. A special train was hurriedly arranged, and for the tired but still euphoric crowds, the uncertainty was over. In the following days, further East Germans fled via the embassy in Prague. The total number is unknown, but is thought to be around 20,000. But all this was just a foretaste for far bigger changes. Just 40 days later, the Berlin Wall was breached. Today, if you look into the German embassy garden from the park behind, you can see a Trabant car on legs. A surreal reminder of the surreal events of that autumn.
That edition of From the Archives by David Vaughan brings us to the end of today's show. We're always happy to get your comments and questions, so do get in touch. The address is Vinohradská 12, 12099 Prague 2, the Czech Republic. And you can also send us an email at english@radio.cz. I'm Jan Richter. For all of us here at Radio Prague, thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.
You.